We filmed a scene in which I brought the balloon down right in the middle of a performance at the Hollywood Bowl. I'd say that was probably worth the price of admission for all of us. After the Matter of Gravity tour, Hepburn worked again with George Cukor, then 79, remaking Emlyn Williams's The Corn is Green. Betty Davis had appeared in the acclaimed 1940s film version, and Kate was pleased when the television production won more kudos for everybody involved. So in the 15 years since Spencer Tracy's death, Katharine Hepburn had been almost as active as she had during any previous period of her life. She cheerfully graced magazine covers and granted interviews, including one with Dick Cavett, the host of a popular late-night television program. In 1974, she startled a worldwide television audience and 1,000 people sitting in the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion when Academy Awards host David Niven unexpectedly announced the next presenter by saying, "To me, this is a star, Katharine Hepburn." She strode out in a black pantsuit and clogs as the stunned crowd rose as one. Hepburn quieted the audience and thanked them for their moving welcome. "I'm also very happy that I didn't hear anyone call out, 'It's about time,'" she said. Then she added, "I'm living proof that a person can wait 41 years to be unselfish." She was there to present the Irving Thalberg Award to her old friend Lawrence Weingarten, who had produced Adam's Rib. After they walked off stage, Hepburn left the winner to face the press alone as she disappeared into a waiting limousine, leaving as suddenly as she had arrived. Hepburn's sightings in Los Angeles and New York, playing tennis with Alex Olmedo at the Beverly Hills Hotel, shoveling snow on East 49th Street, theater going on and off Broadway, became less uncommon but no less thrilling. By the 1980s, most of the male movie stars of Hepburn's generation had died, and the few remaining female stars of her vintage had fallen from sight. A tremor, mostly her head, sometimes her hands, had become increasingly pronounced. Her voice quavered, and skin cancers periodically erupted on her face. Too much time in the sun, no good for redheads. But her strength and energy had not noticeably diminished. She and her friend Noel Willman, who had directed her in a few plays, drove down to Wilmington, Delaware one day to catch a performance of a play called On Golden Pond by Ernest Thompson. Hepburn found it a true depiction of an elderly married couple coping with the difficulties of old age. Although she found the actors at least a generation too young for the parts they were playing, she thought it would make a good movie. So did Jane Fonda. She was intrigued by the relationship between the incommunicative and undemonstrative father and his daughter, who had long sought his approval. It mirrored her relationship with her legendary father, Henry. Not until Jane's production company put the film together and the director, Mark Rydell, introduced them, did the two mythic older stars meet. "It was strange," said Kate of being cast in the film. "It seemed as though I was the mother Jane fantasized having. And if her father and I could make everything all right in the movie, somehow things would be all right in her life. There was certainly a whole layer of drama going on in the scenes between her and Hank, and I think she came by to watch every scene he and I had together. There was a feeling of longing about her." By the end of the shoot, during which Hepburn's character, Ethel Thayer, tries to instill some Yankee virtues into her unforgiving daughter and unyielding husband, Hepburn was full of admiration for Jane Fonda. "We all had a good time making the picture," Kate said. "It was fun." And it allowed Kate to show how spunky she still was, diving fully clothed into Squam Lake, singing and dancing an old campfire song, perfusing her failing husband with love and wisdom. She walked away from the production, thinking how hard it must have been for Jane, being the daughter of this famous figure who was so remote. "Hank Fonda was the hardest nut I ever tried to crack," Kate said. "But I didn't know any more about him after we made the picture than I did at the beginning. Cold, cold, cold." At the start of the production, Hepburn had given Fonda one of Spencer Tracy's favorite hats, and at the end, the actor had reciprocated by presenting her with a painting he had done of three hats, Tracy's in the middle. Kate was touched by the gift, until she realized he had made a print of the picture and given dozens of them away to publicists and friends of friends. "Strange man," she said, "angry at something, and sad." Hepburn had her hand in the script, more, I suspect, than she let on. She turned suddenly modest one evening, talking about the speech in which Ethel tells her husband that he's her white knight, and that he's got to go, go, go. When I suggested that it sounded like pure Hepburn, she immediately spoke of all the hard work the writer had done, defining those characters. Ernest Thompson won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay that year. So did Henry Fonda, his first, which his daughter accepted while he watched on television from his bed only a few months before he died. Breaking her own precedent, Katharine Hepburn won as well, for the fourth time. By then, Hepburn was already appearing in a new work by Ernest Thompson, a play called The West Side Waltz. It was another gerontological study, a woman refusing to bow out of life gracefully. She had hoped somebody might buy the screen rights for her, to co-star with either Elizabeth Taylor or Doris Day, but nobody did. Instead, she committed herself to a film originally entitled The Ultimate Solution of Grace Quigley. Kate said the writer had literally thrown the script over her fence, and she had fallen in love with it. A black comedy about an old woman who hires a hitman, played by Nick Nolte, to bump off her dying friends. Few beyond Hepburn saw the humor. Over the next few years, Kate continued to lose friends and acquaintances, as well as longtime rivals from the 30s, most of whom she barely knew, if at all. Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Myrna Loy, Jean Arthur, Mae West, Irene Dunne, Barbara Stanwyck. Later, Garbo, Dietrich, Greer Garson, Sylvia Sidney, and Claudette Colbert died. Kate's first great friend from the theater, Laura Harding, lived an increasingly sedentary life on her estate in New Jersey, which irritated Kate as much as it bored her. In what proved to be his final months, Kate restruck a warm relationship with Luddy, then a widower and suffering from inoperable cancer. For a while, he accepted his first wife's open invitation to Fenwick. But when the trips became too difficult, she visited him at his own bedside. "I tried to do everything for Luddy that I possibly could, knowing I could never repay him for all the support he had given me," Kate told me 2 decades after his death. "Unimaginable. My life, had it not been for Luddy. He was heaven sent." More than ever, Hepburn cultivated her newer friendships. Cynthia McFadden divorced her husband, and after joining the ABC News team, always made time for Kate. Tony Harvey moved from the city to the Hamptons, but visited regularly at Turtle Bay and Fenwick, and even got her to call on him in Long Island. David Eichler often made the trip north from Philadelphia for dinner and the night. She always got a charge out of seeing Martina Navratilova, one of whose tennis rackets she proudly displayed in the living room, and she always seemed buoyed by gossip columnist Liz Smith, despite her being engaged in what Kate called a moronic profession. Kate also found herself making time for people she normally would never have tolerated. She would invite Corliss Lamont, a highly intelligent but rather ponderous old author and philosopher, to dine any time he called, even though he would sit there for 15 minutes at a time without uttering a word. Kate had gone 2 decades without speaking to Garson Kanin because of his chatty book, Tracy and Hepburn, but even he won back his way into her good graces simply because he was available. "Oh," she said wearily the day after their reunion, "I'm too old to be carrying grudges." But her dance card was no longer filled every night. As often as not, Kate and Phyllis ate dinner alone, in increasing silence. Into her 80s, Hepburn remained professionally active. She continued to make movies for television, which gradually deteriorated in quality, though not necessarily in popularity. She participated in documentary films, sometimes as the subject, just as often to contribute anecdotes about others, be it Spencer Tracy or George Stevens. She tinkered for years on a screenplay titled Me and Phyllis, Scenes of Their Lives Together. It climaxed in the car crash in which Kate almost lost her foot and Phyllis her life. One night in the living room on 49th Street, Kate performed the entire script for me. She captured the dialogue between the two of them in funny detail, and she brought me close to tears a few times in revealing her gratitude for having had somebody so dear as Phyllis in her life. Beyond that, it was a strange piece of work that was meant to be a quasi-documentary, with Hepburn reenacting scenes from her own life. She asked me what I thought of it, and how she might improve it. For a moment, I felt like William Holden stumbling into Norma Desmond's parlor in Sunset Boulevard. "Now remember," she said before I could speak, "don't spoil an old woman's delusions." "Well, it certainly played great tonight," I said. "But do you think it would be as funny on the screen? I mean, wouldn't it be strange?" "Well, you laughed, and I'll be playing me again." Yeah, I said, but you are performing the whole thing as a kind of reading. It'll be different if you're staging it for film, which literalizes everything. Besides, I said, who could possibly play Phyllis? Quite right, Phyllis interjected. Nobody could possibly play me. Kate asked for casting suggestions, and I proposed Mona Washbourne and Mildred Natwick, both of whom had some of Phyllis's fey quality. It's a shame Nigel Bruce is gone, Kate said. Nigel Bruce, queried Phyllis indignantly, to play me? That's ridiculous. You don't have to worry, dearie, he's dead. In fact, several producers showed an interest in Kate's script, though I think a few of them were just interested in spending time with her and shopping her name around town. Joseph E. Levine, a producer with a long and spotty track record, actively pursued the project and claimed for months to have the financing in place. Talks progressed far enough that Kate was once willing to have lunch with him in public. She told me it would be the first time she had eaten in a restaurant in at least 20 years. As that made it an occasion in itself, she selected the Four Seasons. She ate caviar and drank champagne and thoroughly enjoyed herself, but the deal soon fell apart. No matter. Hepburn finished her second autobiographical book, Me, the compilation of pieces she'd been pulling together over the years. Sonny Mehta and everyone else at Knopf backed the book in a tremendous way. When the American Booksellers Association held its large annual trade show in New York late in the spring of 1991, just months before publication, Kate opened her house to the owners of the major bookstores and chains for a cocktail party. For the first time, I saw her panic about the book. While dozens of people milled around the house, some spilling out into the garden on the warm spring evening, Kate pulled me upstairs and said, "Why am I doing this?" I assured her that this party was great public relations, that meeting her was one of the biggest thrills for everybody in that room. "No," she said in frustration. "Why am I publishing this book? I mean, I've gone this long. Why bother?" "Maybe because the public has given you a lot over the years, and you should think of this as giving them something back, a small piece of you for those who care." Kate returned to the party all smiles, and when the books were produced, she autographed copies for everybody who had a hand in its publication. She even agreed to selective publicity. While the book never got penetratingly personal, it illustrated a life of hard work, adventures, and fun. On my next visit to Fenwick, I found a copy of the book just sitting on my bed, autographed with the author's love and thanks. Flipping through the finished work, I also found my name listed with a dozen others in the acknowledgments, calling me her chief critic. I went downstairs and said, "I assume this copy of your book is for me." "Hmm," she said, not wishing to make much of it. "Is it all right?" "Yeah, it's great. Thank you for your kind words. But honestly, Kate, I'm not a critic." "What are you talking about? Of course you are. You're always correcting and criticizing and having the last word." "That's not true," I protested. "I may make the occasional suggestion." "It's quite true. You're doing it right now. My God, you're completely hopeless." One day later that week, when we were back in New York and Me was number one on the bestseller lists, I asked Kate what her most satisfying role had been. "I'd have to say," she replied, pausing, then looking up at the wooden goose hanging from the ceiling as it had years earlier back in the Q Corps guest cottage, "those years I wasn't working." I knew she meant those 5 years just before Spencer Tracy's death. And then she surprised me by remembering exactly the first time that topic had come up. "But," she added with a smile, now that we had covered a lot of ground in the years since then, "I never talk about that time." "Who's Donovan?" Kate asked over the phone one day in the summer of 1990. "Donovan," I asked back. "Why do you want to know about Donovan?" "Who is he?" "Well, he's a singer, kind of a folk rock singer from the 60s. Why do you want to know about Donovan?" "Because I'm going to do his program." "His program? What kind of program?" "His television program." "Kate, this guy was a hippie singer and songwriter from the 60s. I don't think he has a television program. What sort of show do you think he has?" "It's one of those talk shows like Cavett, only it's during the day and he's apparently very popular with all the housewives." "Got it, Kate. His name is Donahue, Phil Donahue. Yes, he's got a very popular show. It'll be great for your book. But you had me worried there for a minute. I thought you were going on some show wearing a headband and love beads." It didn't take much to promote Kate's book, and she did what she was asked. Cynthia McFadden made her promise not to appear on Sally Jesse Raphael or any of the other downmarket shows. There was no need to worry. Nobody knew how to sell Katharine Hepburn better than Katharine Hepburn. In fact, she often talked about herself in the third person, as the creature. She said the creature had become an institution, much like the Flatiron Building or the Statue of Liberty, a bastion that had withstood the tests of time. Me became a phenomenal success, cresting the bestseller list for over a year. After the rush of the book, however, as the sales, interviews, and publicity died down, there was little on Hepburn's plate. For the first time in a long time, at age 85, she didn't know what she even might do next. Scripts still arrived regularly, but most of them were terrible. Patronizing screenplays about cute little old ladies, what a goddamn bore, she said. She received umpteen renditions of the Aspirin papers, one of which she hooted with incredulity was pornographic. Her primary occupation became her mail. A secretary sorted through most of it, then presented her with those letters that required a response. A few warranted handwritten replies, usually written with a black flare pen on Katharine Houghton Hepburn notepaper. Others received dictated responses later in the day. The important missives were alphabetized and filed in fat accordion folders and stored away. Most of the mail came from rapturous fans. Little peeved Kate more than an extravagant letter from an admirer who rhapsodized about her talent and beauty and influence on his or her life, then addressed the envelope to Katharine with an E, Hepburn. God, Kate would splutter, you'd think the first thing they'd learn is how to spell my name. It pleased her that people enjoyed her work, but she found the letters from those who wrote of spending countless hours watching her movies night after night deeply disturbing. If they are really inspired by what I've done with my life, she asked, why don't they do something with theirs, not just watch old movies? More disturbing were the occasional crank letters, sometimes hate mail, usually about her position on abortion. Occasionally there were threats. Whenever she received such a letter, or read about an abortion clinic being bombed by some religious fanatic, Kate would declare, so much for God is love. The hate mail was separated from the rest, but Kate held on to it, tucking it away in a closet off the living room. For Kate, the most distressing aspect of the 1990s was Phyllis's behavior. Her age had long been a mystery, but everybody presumed she was at least a few years older than Kate. As such, she was something of a medical miracle, still going through the motions of her rigorous job every day, 7 days a week. In truth, Kate had really looked after Phyllis more than the other way around for years. Everything about her had slowed. She often needed to lie down. She was frequently confused. Phyllis needs a Phyllis, Kate said. And she hired people to look after her, mostly to see that she didn't wander into harm's way. One Sunday afternoon, I came upon Phyllis in the foyer at Fenwick, just standing there in a daze with one arm in the sleeve of her coat. I asked her if everything was all right. Oh, fine, just fine, she insisted. I just can't remember whether we are coming or going. Kate was becoming lonely. Although Cynthia McFadden saw Hepburn as much as possible, her fast-paced career, new romances, and a baby consumed more and more of her time. Tony Harvey in the Hamptons and David Eichler in Philadelphia found themselves in Manhattan with less frequency, while Kate's pianist friend Laura Frati suffered from ill health and didn't get around much. And I finished my research on Lindbergh and had to go home to Los Angeles to write. For the next few years, I had little reason to travel to the East Coast except to visit Kate. At first, I tried to steal away every month or two. Gradually, my visits decreased to 4 times a year, then 2. I tried to stay in touch by telephone, but Kate always acted slightly hostile toward the instrument or those at the other end. Whenever I called, she would ask where I was, then say, "Well, you're of no use to me there." Then she'd usually add, "You should come back soon, before I'm dead." Our visits remained pleasant, but they were changing. With less stimulation, her life had become stagnant. She moved more slowly, her energy ebbed. Gone were the conversations until midnight, or 10, or even 8. Sometimes she'd want dinner as early as 5 o'clock, and she'd clamber up the stairs to bed, literally using her hands and feet, by 6, before the sun had set. The only thing that kept her downstairs a little longer was to have a drink or two after dinner. In the late 80s, she'd changed brands of scotch, from her King William IV to famous Grouse. She'd been introduced to it by her wealthy relatives in Boca Grande, Florida. "Now, Kate," I said in mock irritation, "I've been telling you about this scotch for years, that all the right people in England drink it. And you ignored me. Now, because some Houghtons drink it, it's okay." She recalled my having discoursed on the subject of famous grouse more than once. "You've caught me, and now you know the truth," she said. "I'm a hopeless snob." I learned from Nora and the other caretakers around both houses that these days Kate was usually having 2 drinks before dinner and 1 or 2 postprandially. They never seemed to affect her physically, but they fogged her mind. She was forgetting things. This new condition worried Nora enough for her to take it upon herself to water down the whiskey. During my visits, she told me she was pouring half the scotch out of the famous grouse bottles and diluting the rest with water. "It's funny," Kate said to me one night at dinner. "I've completely lost all sense of taste. I take a drink and it has no flavor." Unconsciously, Kate was using the liquor as an anodyne, not only to kill the mildly depressing bouts of loneliness, but also her physical pain, which I had long suspected was worse than she ever let on. Emotional situations, a sad scene in a movie, a touching story, a death, could bring her to tears. But only once did I see her cry because something physically hurt. It was a late afternoon in 1992, when she was trying to step onto the bench in the living room to water some plants. She thought she was alone in the room, and I could see she was in agony. At last, she swung her bad foot up, and it clearly ached. She let out a small cry, and I ran in to help her. There were tears in her eyes, and she said she had tripped. Another time in the summer of 1992, we drove to a park near Fenwick to take a walk. It had just started to sprinkle when Kate came upon a great bunch of Queen Anne's lace. There was one absolutely magnificent blossom she insisted on having. She pulled and pulled on the huge flower, but it would not uproot. Then she tried to snap the stalk, but it would only bend, not break. She asked me for the car key, which she used as a saw on the fibrous stem. For several minutes, she stood hunched over the flower, hacking away, as the drizzle turned to rain. Mother Nature was clearly going to win this round, so I said, "Kate, let's go. It's really starting to come down." As she gave up on the plant, I noticed how wet her eyes were, and not from the rain. We drove back to Fenwick in silence. That disturbed me far less than another drive some months later in the spring of 1993. Kate's chauffeur over the last few years, a man of great equanimity, had suddenly died, and a new man was at the wheel. On a Saturday morning, we made the trip from Fenwick to Peg's house for lunch, a trip she had made several thousand times. Approaching Hartford, US 91 offered exits to the east and west, and the driver called out for directions. "East," Kate said firmly. "Aren't we going to Peg's?" I asked. "Of course we're going to Peg's," she said. "Where do you think we're going?" "Well, Peg lives to the west of Hartford." "East! East!" she called out to the driver, then said to me, "You never had any sense of direction. She lives to the east." "Kate," I said, reaching for a map, "unless Peg has moved, she lives to the west of Hartford." I spread Connecticut out on my lap and said, "Here's where we are, and here to the left is Peg." Kate looked thrown, but tried to shrug it off. "All this time," she said, "I always thought that was to the east." Close to 6 months passed before I was again able to leave Los Angeles and visit Kate. By then, she was spending most of her time in Fenwick, using the trips to New York City for meetings with doctors, lawyers, and accountants, appointments that seemed merely a way of differentiating the weeks. In the early fall, I found a free weekend. Because I didn't want her to anticipate my visit for too long, with the possibility of my canceling at the last minute, I didn't call her until Thursday afternoon. I said that I would arrive at Fenwick in time for dinner the next night. We had a nice long talk, and we joked that she would have to wait at least until 5:30 before eating dinner. Early the next morning, I left for New Haven, where I picked up a car and drove on to Old Saybrook. The timing was perfect. I crossed the causeway to Fenwick a little after 5 and pulled into the driveway. A concerned woman looked out at me from the kitchen. This was Hong Luong, the new housekeeper at Fenwick, a strong but kind soul and an able cook. "I hope you're expecting me," I said, reading on her face that she was not. "Don't worry," she said. "There's plenty of food." But I was worried. As I walked into the living room, which was darker than usual and dead quiet, Kate and Phyllis were sitting in their places with television tables set before them, waiting to be served. "Remember me?" I asked. "What are you do?" she started to say. then stopped to amend her greeting. For the first time, I saw Kate embarrassed, even a little ashamed, as she said, "You are entering a house of the very old." I poured a glass of famous grouse, a double, neat, and it tasted of nothing. Chapter 10. Travels with My Aunt. Actors occupy a peculiar place in the social phylum. People who literally stand out from the rest of the species, wanting to be looked at as much as the rest of us want to look at them. They bring stories to life, tapping into our emotions, often becoming the vessels that allow us to experience a moment of realization, sometimes self-recognition. Many become reference points common to people around the world, elements in universally shared experiences. We tend to look upon the practitioners of the acting profession as special. We pamper and praise them. Some people practically worship them. Then there are movie stars, a breed unto themselves. The stakes are so high for those rare few who decade after decade captivate us that we shower rewards upon them. Some are compensated with millions of dollars for a few days of work. Their opinions on all subjects are held in higher regard. We create special rules for them, private entrances and exits for them to pass through. The lives of the biggest movie stars, the superstars, are generally as unreal offstage as the characters they portray. There is a near constant frenzy around them, the whirl of managers and agents and publicists and assistants tending to the constant demands for the star's time, interviews, photograph sessions, public appearances. The ringing telephone becomes an addiction, often sending a star into withdrawal when it stops. For those who became famous under the old studio system, the lack of reality to their lives was even greater, because the contract stars of the 30s, 40s, and 50s had worked constantly. Everything off the set was less important than what they did before the cameras. The studio heads paying the bills protected their own interests and took care of everything in their stars' lives. On the set, doubles were always available for the dangerous or unpleasant duties, whether it was performing a stunt or standing under the hot lights. Off camera, everything was tended to, not just clothing and grooming and personal chores, but even indecent, occasionally illegal activities were cleaned up, swept under the carpet, fixed. Many stars begin to believe their own encomiastic press releases. After a year or a decade, and in a few cases a lifetime of fabulous salaries and fringe benefits, there naturally comes a sense of great expectations. With most movie stars, there also comes a sense of entitlement. Perhaps the most attractive aspect of Katharine Hepburn's personality was that she held no such feelings. She made plenty of demands. Indeed, she knew how to get what she wanted long before she was a star. In part, that's how she got to be a star. But she always remained grounded. In 20 years, I never found a trail of bodies she'd trampled over in order to reach her goal. For all her impatience, there was always a sense of humility and humanity, even a sense of gratitude for her good fortune. She was never above making a bed, cooking a meal, chopping wood, or working her garden. Indeed, she found pleasure in those activities. Almost every time I saw her in the kitchen at Fenwick, she was wiping a sponge across the countertop, cleaning up after somebody. In short, she never lost her work ethic. She believed the point of making money was to allow you to live comfortably enough to work some more, until you simply could work no longer. "Retire!" she had exclaimed one night at dinner, when Irene Selznick had found a gentle way of broaching the topic. "What's the point? Actors shouldn't walk away from the audience as long as the audiences aren't walking away from them. As long as people are buying what I'm selling," she added, "I'm still selling." Kate never understood how people got stuck in jobs they didn't enjoy. Stars who bemoaned the hardships of their profession, the impositions, the loss of privacy, rankled her as though she were embarrassed to be one of them. "These actors who complain in interviews about 12-hour days," she said with incomprehension. "You sit there for 11 of them. It's not as if we're carrying sacks of feed all day." "What does he expect?" she said upon reading about Sean Penn punching out a photographer. "You can't go around saying I'm special. I make my living asking you to look at me, to pay to see me, and then get upset at somebody for taking a picture. If you don't want to be a public figure, don't pick a public profession and don't appear in public. Because in public, you're fair game." She also didn't understand stars who sued newspapers over printing lies about them. "I never cared what anybody wrote about me," Hepburn said, "as long as it wasn't the truth." While she sought the limelight all her life, Hepburn believed actors received too much attention and respect. "Let's face it," she said once, "we're prostitutes. I've spent my life selling myself, my face, my body, the way I walk and talk. Actors say you can look at me, but you must pay me for it." I said that may be true, but actors also offer a unique service. The best of them please by inspiring, by becoming the agents for our emotional catharses. "It's no small thing to move people," I said, "and perhaps to get people to think differently, maybe even behave differently." I pointed out to Hepburn that she had used her celebrity over the years for numerous causes, whether it was marching in parades for women's equality or campaigning for Roosevelt, speaking out against McCarthyism or supporting Planned Parenthood. "Not much, really," Kate said. "I could have done more, a lot more. It really doesn't take all that much to show up for a dinner with the president or to accept an award from an organization so it can receive some publicity. Oh, the hardship. Oh, the inconvenience. Oh, honestly." Los Angeles is, in many ways, a one-industry town. There is obviously a thriving financial sector. Real estate, aerospace, and the music business have all played a large part in the economy and ethos of the city. But motion pictures dominate, pervading all walks of the city's life. Photographs of movie stars decorate the walls of liquor stores, restaurants, even car washes, with best wishes from the likes of Burt Reynolds, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Rock Hudson. Although most people in Los Angeles have never met a movie star, everybody there seems to know them all, through a common trainer or hairstylist or florist or dry cleaner or checker at the supermarket. For close to 70 years, Katharine Hepburn's sightings remained the most coveted of show business personalities, even more than those of Garbo, who could be counted on to take her daily constitutional on the streets of New York. One rarely heard a first-hand Katharine Hepburn story. Although some of my friends knew of my relationship with her, mostly because her name appeared on the dedication page and in the acknowledgments of Goldwyn, few ever invaded her privacy by even asking me about her. Although I had known Warren Beatty through several friends and my older brother Jeff, the head of International Creative Management, a major talent agency, I had never met him until early 1993. Then I began receiving calls from his wife's agent. He said Annette Bening had long been fascinated with Anne Morrow Lindbergh, and she was hoping I might be able to meet her sometime to talk about what I had gleaned from the Lindbergh's private archives. An insistent third call from the agent expressed the fact that Warren Beatty was eager to meet me as well, and that somebody would be calling very soon to arrange a dinner. 5 months passed, in which I heard nothing. In mid-July, the agent called again to set our date. I said this no longer seemed like such a good idea, that after half a year there seemed something slightly forced in the situation. "No," the agent explained, "Warren Beatty was extremely interested in our meeting." I had not heard from anybody, he explained, because Warren had, in fact, been occupied producing, rewriting, and starring in a film called Love Affair. It was a remake of the 1957 movie An Affair to Remember, which starred Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr, which was a remake of Love Affair, made in 1939 with Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne, all based on a story by Mildred Cram. He and Annette, I was told, very much wanted to get together as soon as possible. On Wednesday, July 21st, Kevin McCormick, a film producer who had recently become an executive at 20th Century Fox, and I drove from our house in the hills above the Sunset Strip to Mulholland Drive, where we were buzzed through the Beatty's gate at exactly 7:30. In the living room, we found Warren playing with his 18-month-old daughter, entertaining two other guests, the agent and a female executive from another studio. Annette darted in to say hello and then went to put her daughter to bed. For several minutes, our host chatted with all of us. Then we repaired to the dining room for dinner, where Annette joined us. Few movie stars look as good in person as they do on screen, where they benefit from makeup and lights. The Beattys, however, did. He was taller than I'd expected, and his face was starting to show some attractive character lines I hadn't seen on film. She glowed. The house was comfortable and unostentatious, though the dining room ceiling could be retracted, letting guests feel as if they were outdoors. We ate indoors that night, a tasty but extremely dietetic meal of chicken and vegetables and a fruit dessert. A bottle of wine sat on the table, but neither of the hosts indulged, imbibing only water. Conversation quickly turned to my work on Lindbergh. Annette and the three other guests just sat and ate, as Warren peppered me with questions about the famous aviator. He was surprised and pleased to learn that the story included so much politics, starting with Lindbergh's grandfather, who had been elected to the Swedish Riksdag and had been forced to leave his homeland because of a political and sexual scandal, including Lindbergh's father, who had been a controversial five-term congressman, right up to Lindbergh himself, known for his role in the little-understood America First movement. I tried to include everybody at the table in the discussion, often lassoing Kevin in for his astute political commentary, but Warren was not much interested. That night, I was the only person on whom he fixed his attention. A little after 10, the conversation changed, but the conversants did not. While the other guests grew restless, our host shifted the dialogue to Goldwyn. "Is it true I was the last person Sam Goldwyn talked to before he died?" Beatty asked me. "Not quite," I explained. But Warren Beatty had, in fact, been the last name recorded on Goldwyn's telephone sheet before suffering the stroke that ended his career. Then, just as the other guests were getting up from the table, bored to tears, I feared, the conversation took another sudden shift. "I guess you know Katharine Hepburn pretty well," he said, "because I see you dedicated your book to her." While Annette started shepherding the others toward the door, Warren lingered behind with me, quickly measuring the depth of my friendship with Kate. "Do you think she'd like to work again?" he asked. "Not right away," I said, as she had recently finished a rather uninspiring television movie. "Well," he followed up, "do you think she's able to work again?" I said she was definitely capable, but her interest was waning along with her health. She had skin cancers on her face, she was not sleeping soundly, and she was suffering from dizzy spells. Her shaking often became more pronounced, I said, and she'd taken to working off cue cards. "Oh, that doesn't matter," Warren said. "Jack uses them too," meaning his friend Mr. Nicholson. "Because there's a great part in our movie," he continued. "The old aunt?" I asked, slightly incredulously. "Is that really a great part?" While the old aunt in Love Affair was but a supporting role, the character did serve as a kind of fulcrum, appearing in one extended scene in the middle of a sentimental story about a long-time bachelor about to marry. This man about town meets a singer, also about to marry, on a cruise, and their sudden love for each other becomes apparent during a brief layover at a European port, where they meet the man's elderly aunt, who is charmed by the young woman and wishes them godspeed. The ageless beauty Kathleen Nesbitt played the part in the Cary Grant version. The character actress Maria Uspenskaya played opposite Boyer. In this new version, the port of call had become Tahiti, the exteriors of which had already been shot. Beatty told me that Hepburn would have to travel no farther than the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank, where her character's house was being built on a soundstage. Her dressing room would be constructed literally steps from the set. "Even if she wanted to work again," I told Warren, "you've got to remember that Hepburn has never played anything but the female lead. With the exception of her scene in Stage Door Canteen, she's always been the star. No supporting roles, no cameos, no commercials. And the only reason she did Stage Door Canteen was as part of the war effort. This picture, I thought, isn't exactly in the national interest." As he and I made our way out to the driveway, where the other guests were driving off and Kevin was talking with Annette, Warren explained that the film was virtually finished except for this one long scene, which required an actress of stature. Moreover, he said, he wanted an actress in her 80s who looked as though she was in her 80s, not an octogenarian who had been tucked and pulled, nor a sexagenarian caked in makeup. "Not only that," he said at last, "I've always been in love with Katharine Hepburn." Ever since he had been a young man, he said, she had bowled him over with her brains, her beauty, her attitude. "She's very sexy," he said. "That's what Howard Hughes thought," I replied, knowing that Beatty had talked of producing a film about Hughes for more than a decade. "Yeah, what about that?" Warren said, as I was getting into the car, which Kevin had started up. "Did she ever talk to you about Hughes?" After I told him that she had, I could see he was prepared to pump me all night. I figured the only way we could leave was if I threw him a bone, so I said, "Kate often told me what you must always remember about Howard is that he was deaf, and from an early age that affected him." As the car began to move, Warren followed along for a few paces, continuing the conversation mostly about how chancy a sentimental love story was these days. "Well," said Kevin, as we reached the end of the driveway, "now I see what dinner was all about." I said he was being ridiculous, that the purpose of the evening was to learn about Lindbergh, and now that Warren had learned all I was willing to impart, that would be the last I would ever hear from him. We arrived home at 11. At 11:05, the phone rang. Kevin said, Warren. "This is Warren Beatty, the movie star," said the exuberant voice at the other end of the line. "It was really great meeting you guys," he said. Then he chatted aimlessly about Lindbergh for a few minutes before asking, "So do you think Hepburn might be interested in doing this part?" I reiterated that it seemed unlikely, but I volunteered to inquire discreetly. "This much I can tell you," I added. "Don't approach her right away. She likes to feel she's coming in to save the day. She loves to save the day." In the meantime, I advised him to tailor the scene in ways that might especially appeal to her. I further advised that he think of other actresses who could play the part, so that he wouldn't be stuck in the probable eventuality that she wouldn't do it. Obviously, Beatty had already compiled such a list. I pushed Frances D., Hepburn's co-star in Little Women, saying that I had seen her in recent years and that she was an extremely attractive older woman with all her wits. "I know," Beatty said, "but I think the part needs a bigger name, a real star." I mentioned Louise Rayner, who had won back-to-back Oscars in the 1930s for The Great Ziegfeld and The Good Earth, and who was also in her 80s. Furthermore, I argued, she'd been off the screen for decades, so the studio could probably get some publicity mileage out of the casting. "No," Beatty whined, "she just doesn't seem right." I argued that the part sounded more appropriate for her than for Hepburn. "I could see Louise Rayner languishing in her final days in Tahiti," I said, "but not Kate. No balmy breezes for her. Greenland, maybe. Or the Yukon, but not Tahiti." That seemed like a frivolous technicality to Beatty, who added, "I just don't see Louise Rayner as my aunt." "I've always found Hepburn really sexy," he told me again. In that moment, what I had long known became perfectly clear. I realized that even for movie stars, Katharine Hepburn was the actress they all wanted to meet and the one with whom they all dreamed of working. Once again, I said I would sound Hepburn out, but that he should also think about Wendy Hiller, Loretta Young, Jessica Tandy. "The old lady lives in Tahiti," I suggested before hanging up. "How about Dorothy L'Amour coming out in a sarong?" I called Kate the next morning, waiting until 7:30 Los Angeles time, knowing that one could no longer call her at any time. In fact, she often didn't awaken until 8, sometimes 9, and then she lingered in bed reading, writing, and sorting through her mail. I told her about my evening with Warren Beatty and his interest in getting her in his movie. "Tell him you spoke with me," she directed, "and that I have absolutely no interest in the film. Is that the one where the girl gets hit by the car on her way to the Empire State Building?" she asked. I complimented her on her memory. She seemed to have been approached to appear in this version of the film already, and she wrote the story off as pretty silly stuff. "My God," she added, "have I become Maria Uspenskaya?" Strangely, our conversation on the subject did not end there. "Is he interesting?" she asked, indicating Warren Beatty. "I'm not sure," I said. "He's certainly engaging. He gives the big rush, and he has a kind of courtliness. I think you'd like him." "Why does he want to remake that movie?" she asked. "Cary Grant, I think." "Cary Grant?" I told her a story I'd heard years earlier, about Cary Grant walking into a big Hollywood party in the 60s, where he saw all the gorgeous women in the room swarming around the young Warren Beatty. Grant was said to have commented to a friend, "See that guy? That used to be me." "Now," I told Kate, "I think Mr. Beatty wants to be Cary Grant. No man aged more gracefully on the screen than your friend Cary, and when he was 53, he made an affair to remember." "How old is Warren Beatty?" she asked. 56. "Is he any fun?" she asked. "I'm not sure," I said. "He takes himself extremely seriously, but I think that's so people around him will take him seriously. But I have a hunch he's kind of goofy underneath it all." "Hmm," said Kate. "Well, that could be fun." I reported most of the conversation to Warren and suggested that he leave her alone as long as possible, that in closing the door she had left a slight crack. It was a clear signal that Hepburn was ready neither to end her career nor to commit to anything new. I told him that I would be visiting her in New York in early September, and I could take her pulse in person. At that dinner in New York, I raised the subject of the Warren Beatty movie. Again, she was noncommittal. With such a small role, she asked, what was the point? I said that it might be fun to do such a part, one that would make a great impression and wouldn't require much time or effort. Besides, I argued, it would be nice circumstances under which to visit her friends in Los Angeles, something she hadn't done in years. "They're all dead," she said. "Well, I'm not," I protested. "If you keep talking about this movie," she said, "you will be." Most people, even in Hollywood, don't know exactly what a producer does. In fact, producers come in all varieties and perform any number of functions. Some seize an idea or get their hands on a piece of unpublished material and shepherd it to a studio, where they develop it into a motion picture. Others simply raise the money for the venture. Studios often stir other producers into the stew because of their ability to lure big stars and prominent directors. Still, other producers get assigned to a film because of their ability to make the trains run on time, seeing that the dozens of artists and technicians and drivers and caterers all perform their tasks according to the budget. Such extensive division of labor accounts for the large number of producers one finds in the credits of motion pictures today. In the golden age of Hollywood, each film generally had one producer and perhaps an associate who monitored the mechanics of the physical production. In more modern times, there are very few producers who conceive a film project and oversee its journey from inception to exhibition. The conglomeratization of the studios is in part the reason for the increase in number of producers, as bean-counting corporate heads want to ensure their ever-increasing investments by hiring high-paid specialists to perform each production task. Another reason is that there's little room for the big personalities that existed in the old studio system, men like Goldwyn and Selznick and Thalberg, whose passion practically willed their movies into existence. Not long after remaking Love Affair popped into my life, I asked a venerated member of the Hollywood community what he thought of Warren Beatty. As an actor, he said, he had one of the greatest 10 years an actor can have, and since then his career has pretty much slipped, and so has his acting. As a director, he's had a couple of good pictures, but as a producer, he's one of the best I've ever seen in this town. He can get anybody to do anything. That's producing. Into the fall of 1993, I watched Warren Beatty produce. He made contact with Hepburn herself and her no-nonsense financial advisor named Eric Hansen. Upon learning that Kate liked cut flowers, Beatty began sending arrangements, one after another. I, too, began to receive his calls. At first, they came once a week to devise a game plan, then once a day, soon 5 times a day, analyzing every word she had said to him and strategizing every word he might say back. The calls were always flattering and full of excitement, manipulation so overt that it was comical. Kate was amused as well and called one morning to say, "Please tell your friend, Mr. Beatty, to stop sending me flowers. It looks like a funeral parlor around here." She clearly enjoyed the seduction. But as December arrived, the courtship had to end. The film's remaining scenes had to be shot, with or without Katharine Hepburn. Feelers had been put out to Francis D., who was standing by in case her old friend Kate declined. Meantime, Hepburn's health was failing. Her energy was not what it had been even the year before, and her short-term memory came and went. She found it difficult to concentrate. She asked what I thought of the script, as she could make little sense of it. When I told her I'd not seen it, she asked me to call Warren Beatty and request a copy. I did, suggesting that Hepburn herself realized that this might very well be her swan song and that she wanted it to be special. Toward that end, I said, he should consider interpolating a few lines that would be personal, not just in style, but also in substance. I was thinking of dialogue that might comment upon the character's life and philosophy, but which was obviously drawn from Hepburn's as well, rather the way Spencer Tracy had spoken his heart in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Beatty messengered a script over. Not the entire script, actually, just the 15 pages that featured old Aunt Ginny. They didn't seem like much to me. In the first of my calls from Warren the next day, I asked, "Who wrote this?" The simple question elicited a most complicated answer. Of the sort one found in most of his interviews, rambling and evasive, "Oh, it's really hard to say. A lot of people have had their say, and of course it goes back to the original movie and Mildred Cram and..." The best I've gathered since is that Robert Towne wrote the script, with Beatty rewriting, or vice versa. Hepburn also called that day and asked what I thought of the script. I said I thought it was pretty mediocre, flat and charmless. "I thought I was the only one," she said. "That puts an end to that." But, I added, there was still plenty of time to fix it, because it was potentially a wonderful scene. "What's the point?" Hepburn asked. "Why bother?" The fact that she even asked, that none of her refusals to do this movie had sounded definitive, made me think she really wanted to take the job. If they could have shot the scene in New York, I don't think she would have hesitated for a moment. But this would mean uprooting herself and moving to California for several weeks, and I think that for the first time, She was factoring her age and health into the equation. Beatty promised to find her a comfortable house, one that could easily accommodate Nora and anyone else with whom she wanted to travel. Of course, she could select the personnel tending to her hair and makeup and costumes. Kate seemed to be wondering if she would be alone during this venture. Laura Harding had been there for her in the old days, but she was estate-bound in New Jersey. Phyllis had become too feeble to make the trip, and Cynthia McFadden, who had become Kate's favorite companion on both business trips and vacations, could no longer simply take time off from work. When Kate asked again what the point was in doing the film, I felt she was asking whether or not I would be around. "I think you should do it," I said. "You always said actors act, so I think you should act. Do you need this movie for your career? I don't think so. But I think it could be fun. We can have some adventures in L.A., and you'll be starting your 7th decade in movies. Now that's pretty great. A career that goes from John Barrymore to Warren Beatty." "Jesus," she said. "I might have to say yes just to stop him from sending any more flowers." "I believe that's part of his campaign, Kate, to show you the kind of attention he'll lavish upon you." "We've run out of room here," she said, "so it shows me that he's a goddamned fool for wasting so much money." I updated Warren Beatty, explaining that Kate would probably flip-flop another dozen times in the next 2 weeks, and that left to her own volition, she would prefer to stay home. "She's 85, I reminded him. All that said, I told Beatty that I would be willing to fly east to reassure Hepburn of the soundness of this venture, and that I would accompany her to Los Angeles. I also said that if he wanted to act on his own, that would be fine with me as well. In any case, I added, you really should let up on the flowers. Christmas Day, a Saturday, Beatty called to say if my offer still held, we should leave on Monday, the 3 p.m. flight. Hepburn still had not committed to the role, but her deal had been negotiated, her backup team was on alert, and accommodations were being arranged. We just had to lure the lion out of her lair. Because we would be arriving in New York long after Hepburn's bedtime, I asked him to book a hotel room for me on Monday night and to make a dinner date with Hepburn for Tuesday. Meantime, I would call Kate and arrange to be with her Tuesday afternoon to discuss the trip. I would stay for dinner and spend the night upstairs, because Wednesday morning she would rise with absolutely no intention of leaving for California. Monday morning, Beatty called to say a car would pick me up at 2 o'clock, return to his house to fetch him, then we'd go to the airport. "Isn't that cutting it a little close?" I asked. He said he didn't think so, but I could have the car come whenever I wanted. He asked if I would bring a copy of Hepburn's Me, which he had not read, and for comfort's sake, I asked for an extra 15 minutes. That quarter of an hour proved worthless, because when I arrived at Beatty's house on Mulholland, he was still running around gathering things for the trip and fielding phone calls. We met in the kitchen at 2:15, where he insisted we eat some roast beef hash the cook was preparing. At 2:25, I suggested we move along if we were to catch our 3 o'clock flight. "Okay," he said, downing the last of the hash. At 5 minutes before the hour, we arrived at the American Airlines terminal, where a special representative met us curbside. We must have walked through security, but I don't remember it, as we were escorted right onto the plane. The first-class stewardess had our names and greeted me and Mr. Mike Gambrill, the name of Beatty's character in the movie. The first-class section was empty except for us, and Warren used the flight to whip through Hepburn's book, periodically asking for amplification on one chapter or another. We were whisked through JFK and taken to the Carlisle Hotel, where I was shown to an enormous suite, a big bedroom, 2 baths, and a huge living room, easily costing $1,000 a night. It was only 9 o'clock California time when Warren rang and asked me to accompany him to P.J. Clark's for a bite. The restaurant was quiet at that hour, except for a rowdy group of young Italians sitting a few tables away. They periodically pointed to my dinner companion and chanted, "Dick Tracy, Dick Tracy!" Our chatty waitress kept lingering at our table, and when she brought our salads, she seized the moment to ask Beatty if he remembered her. She said they had dated some 10 years prior. He said he did remember her, which put a big smile on her face. And when she left, he told me that even though she had put on some weight, he did recognize her. As we were leaving the restaurant, one of the Italian men asked Dick Tracy for his autograph, which Beatty happily provided. "Where does Hepburn go out to eat?" Warren asked as we headed out. "She doesn't," I said. "No, I mean when she goes out, what restaurant does she go to?" I explained that she hardly went to restaurants at all, maybe 3 in the last 20 years, and only once in the last decade that I was aware of. "Why?" he asked in disbelief. First of all, she knows she'll get better food at home, and she also knows that people will be watching her every time she lifts the fork. And then there's those guys, I added, pointing back to the jovial Italians. Warren laughed, put his arm on my shoulder, and said, "That's the reason I do go out to restaurants." It was after 1 when we returned to the hotel, but it was still early on Warren's wristwatch. Although it was already evident that alcohol was not part of his diet, he asked me if I'd join him for a drink in the hotel bar. "What do you drink?" he asked. And I told him single malt scotch or famous grouse. "What does Miss Hepburn drink?" he asked. "The same," I said. He ordered 2 famous grouses. "How do we like it?" he asked me. "Neat," I said. "Neat," he called out to the bartender, delighting in making his request. For the next hour, we sat at the bar. "Another," he called out with glee. And he was warm, funny, self-deprecating, inquisitive, and positively reverent every time he spoke of Hepburn, to whom he hoisted the 2nd glass. The next afternoon, I went to Turtle Bay with my overnight bag, parked it downstairs in case the plan backfired, and went to the living room where I found Kate examining the script of Love Affair. "I have no idea what this scene is supposed to be about," she kept saying. "Let's ask him when he gets here," I said, "and see if it can be rewritten." Beatty was all charm at dinner, attentive to his hostess and even a little nervous. He spoke of the house he had found for her in California, not far from the studio and even closer to his house at the top of Benedict Canyon. The Warner's private jet, he said, would be available at noon to fly us to Burbank. Nora was in a swivet, barely able to keep her eyes off him as she ran trays up and down the stairs. I asked if there was still time to tinker with the script, and the producer and co-writer assured Kate that she would not have to film a word of it until she was satisfied. Hepburn came around. She said she would fly to California and appear in the picture. A little after 8, she was ready to retire and asked where I'd be spending the night. I said that Warren had a suite at the Carlisle for me, but that I would prefer to stay on the 4th floor.
"Good idea," she said. "Save the $45.
$45? I laughed. Realizing she was way off, Kate tried again.
$65?
Kate said her goodnights and went upstairs, followed by Nora, who had already packed most of Hepburn's clothes for the journey. I went downstairs to get my bag and show Warren out. He felt good about the way the evening went. "But listen," I said, "it's not over. She's going to wake up tomorrow and refuse to go." I suggested he put Eric Hansen on alert, and I told Warren to be ready to return to the house himself at 9 for the final round of persuasion. Winter weather had arrived in New York, and Nora beamed at the thought of 3 weeks in Los Angeles, with Warren Beatty no less. The next morning I went downstairs at 7:30 to get my breakfast tray, which I brought up to Kate's room. She was propped up in bed, pouring another cup of coffee and poring over the script.
"It's really terrible," she said. "I read it, and it makes absolutely no sense." "Here," she said, throwing her copy across the bed, "you play it."
I acted out the scene, which included some drivel likening the promiscuous Beatty character to a duck. Kate rolled her eyes. "It'll be fine once you get out there," I said reassuringly.
"Out where?" she asked blankly.
"L.A.
"L.A.? I'm not going to L.A.
I said I was under the impression she was, that she had told Warren Beatty that she was, and that the Warner's jet was scheduled to take off at noon.
"Well," she insisted, "I will not be on it."
The next few hours were bedlam. I called Warren a little after 9, and when the operator patched me through to his room, it sounded as though I had awakened him. I said he had better come over right away, that Hepburn was back at square one. He said he would be there in an hour. I suggested he get Eric Hansen over to the house as well. Nora efficiently finished Hepburn's packing and put the house in order. I continued to tell Kate that she should make the trip and that she could get sick and return home if she wanted, but that it might just be some fun. She would not budge, clearly waiting to be wooed one more time by Beatty. He arrived a little after 10 and restated how important it was to him and the movie that she appear. But it really wasn't until Eric Hansen, the financial advisor, arrived that she was moved into action. In a sharp tone, he argued that there was no good reason for her to stay home, that she had nothing to do there but sit around and look at the same 4 walls. Here was an opportunity, he said, for her to travel in great comfort and work under ideal circumstances. A little before noon, Nora, Warren, Kate, and I were packed in a limousine on our way to the airport, in dead silence.
Kate looked miserable, sad and tired, like some exotic animal that had been bagged. "Now, Warren," I asked, for Hepburn to hear, "if at any time Kate wants to come home, she can come home, right?"